Turn to Matthew 15. Matthew 15, we're continuing our study of the miracles. We're wanting to fall in love with Jesus again as we spend time with Him. Miracles in class and the upper room discourse in our sermon. We come to an awkward miracle. And we see and hear things that we're not used to seeing when associating Jesus with other people. Matthew 15:21, and I'll interject the additions of Mark 7. I'm reading from the Chronological Bible, Mark Moore's book, and a few additions, but for the most part, it's the same story. A Syrophoenician woman is introduced to us, and Moore makes the comment that this is a pathetic woman for a lot of reasons. First of all, in her society, she's a woman, and every good Jew would seek to avoid her. She comes from a background that was not pleasant to a Jewish community. He makes the observation, I would not have known it, but she is nationally a Phoenician. Politically, she's Syrian, born in Syria, Phoenicia, a Greek, another word, a Gentile. And she comes from a vicinity that she would have heard about Jesus, and her comments to him tell us that she's trying to be very respectful toward him because of the circumstances between these two people. Matthew 15:21, leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. Mark tells us that he entered a house and did not want anyone to know it, yet he could not keep his presence secret. So Mark tells us something. It's in the time frame of healing 5,000 men, plus women and children. It's also in the time frame of the death of John the Baptist, and a great deal of emotion in the area, and certainly in the mind and heart of Jesus. So he's somewhat secretive in this enemy territory, Moore says, and the seclusion doesn't last very long. A Canaanite woman, a Greek born in Syria, Phoenicia, Mark tells us, from that vicinity, as soon as she heard about him, came to him crying out, Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession. Mark adds, my little daughter, connoting perhaps a younger daughter. The fact that she refers to him as the son of David gives us the understanding that she was aware of who he was, of his messiahship. That's the term used. Mark Moore says it's a kosher introduction. You can't go wrong referring to him in that way, and that makes sense. And certainly, he trying to get away, she found him. And we can understand if we've ever had children or family members who are desperately sick, we would walk miles and miles and miles and do anything and everything to find help. Just to go to the trouble would show some level of faith on her part. It could be a desperate act, certainly. But her comments to him when she meets him reflects her appreciation for the environment and for the nationality issues of that time. It certainly helps us to understand because she's going on behalf of a daughter, a little daughter, she desperately needs him to help. And Matthew 15:23 is very specific in its language. Jesus did not answer a word. Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." We found out in being around people, teenagers, children, if they come and ask you something, and it's a little bit out there, maybe there's a cost involved, maybe there's some question about what you plan to do, you won't answer them right away. Silence gives you the opportunity to see how much they want what they're asking for. And if you're dealing with adolescents, many times they'll very quickly see something, go another place, and won't have any recognition of what they were wanting so desperately just moments earlier. If someone asked a second time, what would be your response? What's the human response to the second request? Child, adult, whomever. Well, this is a little more serious to them. And while I might not listen beforehand, I will listen now, or I'll give consideration for it. And in this case, the disciples say, "Let's send her away because she keeps crying out to us." She was not going to leave without having some type of a response, not from the disciples. She's already seen their response, and she likely heard these words. Jesus did not answer a word. But then in verse 24, he answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." Is that true? Of course. When he sent the disciples out in Matthew 10, and this is after those occasions, he says, "Go and seek first those who are part of the lost sheep of Israel." And throughout the book of Acts, you see the apostles going to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. They would give the Jewish audience an opportunity, but then they would spread the message to those who would show interest. And so Matthew is showing us some things that are common to a Jewish audience. That's who he was writing to. And he's going back to things that had history to them. And it would also put him in a position to hear from her, to learn something or to teach something in this circumstance. And this doesn't seem to match what we would have expected Jesus to say. But he's not through yet. It gets worse, if you will. But it's an opportunity for us to learn a message. Matthew 15, verse 25, the woman came and knelt before him. Mark says she fell at his feet. "Lord, help me," she said. Mark tells us she begged Jesus to drive the demon out of her daughter. And he replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." Mark tells us, first let the children eat all they want. What did he just call this woman? A dog. And what he's doing is parroting words that others would have used toward her. And he wanted her to hear that. He needs us to hear it. Now, I have conversations from time to time about those who have pets. we have some grand pets. They're pets that our grandchildren have. And they're under strict rules that when you come to visit, the pets stay home. Some places where we live, they don't allow pets in those homes. But pets are part of the family. If you've ever watched Andy Griffith or any of the old shows, probably the new ones too, it's not unusual to take food from the table and share it with the pets. Now, when my mother fixed me scrambled eggs in the morning, I wish I had a pet to share it with. She loved her children, but fixing breakfast for 11 people, her scrambled eggs had lace around them. Do you know what I'm talking about? I want my scrambled eggs light and fluffy, no lace. And I would have loved to have had a pet to feed my scrambled eggs too. But Jesus is saying something very common. He's using an expression to denote what many people see her as, not worthy, not much different than a dog. And he says that to where she can hear it. The response is really good. Yes, Lord. But even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Mark adds, actually that's Mark's reply, that fall from their master's table, the Matthew adds. Then he told her, "Woman, you have great faith, your request is granted. For such a reply, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." And Matthew tells us, and her daughter was healed from that very hour. She went home and found her child lying on the bed and the demon gone. Moore makes the observation that this woman left her pride at home and went and did what she had to do to help her daughter. And overcoming all the ethnic and national difficulties, what does Jesus look for? And it's not always the case as we've looked at miracles. He noticed her faith. He didn't say it. The disciples did. She's going to wear us out with her words if we don't send her away. Send her away. She's just constantly crying out to us. And yet Jesus shows us not only, again, power over a demon, and he tells us it's the long-distance miracle. Space and time did not matter. He had done other miracles for Gentiles, Matthew 8, Luke 7. But this is the clearest statement to date of the kingdom extending beyond the nation of Israel. This one really makes that point. And that's why Matthew includes it, we think, as well as showing Jesus' response to a Phoenician woman. Tommy? Yep.
He called her daughter.
Yep.
He's calling her woman. That's not as near a personal or loving term as daughter.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There is a difference here.
Yeah, and we'll look at the healing of those two women of winter. Chuck Swindoll called them in his teaching. The women of winter, that will come at another time. Matthew 15, verse 29, he went up on the mountainside and sat down. And there some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged him to place his hand on the man. Now that's Mark 7, 32 and following, and Matthew 29. Turn to Mark 7 and let's let him take us through this miracle. After he took him aside, away from the crowd, Jesus put his fingers into the man's ears. Then he spit and touched the man's tongue. And he looked up to heaven and with a deep sigh said to him, Ephphatha, and I'm not sure how to pronounce it, which means be opened. At this, the man's ears were opened, his tongues were loosened, and he began to speak plainly. If you're asking yourself the question that others would ask, I have no answer. Why did he put his finger into his ears and touch his tongue? My guess is so people could see his part in the healing. And it also was to acknowledge for us that this person did have speech and hearing problems. It wasn't some psychological circumstance. It wasn't some trickery. It wasn't something that... It was just very clear. Jesus, with his actions, showed us the problem that the man had. And he dealt with it. We take it for granted. We have family members who are in speech and therapy. That's what they do for a living. And you'll see from time to time things on YouTube or things being given to us of a child that has gone through a process, whether surgery or a new device, and it shows their face light up and their eyes light up when they hear a voice for the first time. And it's a beautiful picture for someone who's hearing where they've never heard before. We can only imagine what's taking place here. Now, this is consistent with Mark's gospel. Mark tends to go to a place, he gives us the short version of a story, and then he moves on. It was as if someone said the Gentiles had a low attention level. They weren't going to stay for a long time, and so Mark's gospel is it moves quickly from place and from event to event. And Mark doesn't give us much here. Matthew doesn't as well because we have two versions of it. But he does what he needs to do to perform this miracle. Any faith involved that you can see? It's different. And when you look at the so-called miracle workers today, they will use as the excuse that they did not have faith. And that's why they were not healed. And they'll use that as their reasoning for the healing to not take place. I came up with something that I plan to talk about in coming weeks, not here, but in other venues. Those who are secular in their backgrounds, who don't read Colossians 1 verse 17 and believe that at some point the world is going to come to an end, don't understand what we learned long ago in the Old Testament and is true in the New Testament. How do you determine if a prophet is a good prophet or not? What's the test? The prophecy comes true. And what ought to be the red flag that's waved constantly when someone prophesies again, having prophesied something that has not come true? That's a false prophet. It's time for our generation to declare some of the environmentalist false prophets. 10 and 20 years ago, proclaiming this and that. Absolute outrageous temperatures and whole communities flooded or whatever it might be. Look at the time, look at the prophecy, if you will, and declare them. Did it come true? And they don't. And it's time we understand that and quit giving them voice. On this occasion, some of the things that were told would come true. Acts 2 and into Acts 8 and Acts 10, the Samaritans and then the Gentiles would come into the kingdom. They would be welcomed into the kingdom. But it's not always a part of faith that Jesus performs a miracle. It's not always a sign of their faith. And that being the case, why did he perform the miracle? We need to understand that, I think. Why did he perform a miracle where there was no visible faith? Now, she was probably showing some faith, and she probably was very courageous. But in the circumstances where it's more of Jesus and a whole lot less them, why does he do it? And? For others' faith. And we're going to see that in the verses. Look at Mark 7, verse 36. Jesus commanded them not to tell anyone. But the more he did so, the more they kept talking about it. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done something well, they said. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. He did it for others to see it, for others to be put in a position of making a decision. Do I believe it or not? And if I believe it, how will it change my actions? And numbers of people, multitudes of people, and we've only read some of the statements. There's been many up to this point, where many people came to Jesus and many were healed of their sicknesses and diseases, we're told. So he does it for the benefit of others, if you will. And on the heels of chronology, after these events, at least they seem to be recorded, we see the feeding of the 4,000. So 5,000 in between some other actions and the feeding of the larger. Turn to Mark 8, verse 22. We want to spend our time looking at the healing of two blind men this morning. Mark 8, verse 22. And it's a two-step healing, if you will. A two-step healing. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. And when he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" And he looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. And then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And Jesus sent him home saying, "Don't go into the village." Now, Jesus was smart enough to at least offer his request, but also wise enough to realize he's probably not going to follow your advice. You don't get healed from being blind without, first of all, wanting to see anything and everything and telling everybody what's happened. I've shared the story before. You do not tell a teenager as you're going out the house on a Friday night to go with your spouse to see a movie. Now, do not turn to CBS at 9:30. You stay away from the television and we'll see you tomorrow. What have you just done? It's the wet paint syndrome. It's the wet paint syndrome. Don't touch wet paint. And you could walk by that bench a million times and could care less, but as soon as someone says, don't touch wet paint, what do some people want to do? For some reason, we are motivated, for lack of a better word, to go check it out. Is it really wet? Do you care? Well, yes, I do now. You've told me it's wet and don't touch. That's human nature. Jesus knew their human nature, but he was still at least saying what he wanted to take place because he was being inundated with huge amounts of people. Great multitudes, the Gospels tell us. Multitudes. And many of them coming out of their way to find him. Why did he do it this way? Ophthalmologists tell us something that we might need to remember. Once a person has been blind for a period of time, their cerebral cortex has to be completely reprogrammed before they can make sense of the massive data that floods through their eyes after a successful surgery. It can take months. Until then, the data is often perceived as flat surfaces of parallel and crisscrossing lines. When the man Jesus healed reporting people or men walking trees, this may not have been a poetic image, but a clinical description. His eyes were healed, but it took a second reprogramming, if we would use that phraseology, for the cerebral cortex to be completely functional again. Now, I'm not suggesting that Jesus didn't have the ability to do it 100 miles away. And he didn't have to touch and spit and all of that. He's doing it on behalf of the people around him. And he did it in a two-step nature so as to what? Spare the man's eyes to see it all at once? I'm not suggesting that would have been necessary. Because Jesus healing completely, one step, that would have been taken care of. Two of my children wear contacts, and many of you may too. And I'm amazed. I had two cataract surgeries before moving here in November, moved here in late January, and they take out God's lens and put in a synthetic lens. And supposedly my sight, unless a cataract develops again, a cataract I will never need a change of prescriptions because the synthetic lens is permanent as compared to the lens that I had otherwise. I was told that some people would have one lens for farsightedness and another lens for nearsightedness. And with just a little bit of time, guess what would happen? Your mind would reprogram. Cerebral cortex, we're told. And your mind would eventually see just as you would if you have progressive glasses to where it's all here for all things. It's amazing. If you put one hand in front of an eye, just for further proof, if you put one hand in front of one eye, I'm doing it right now, and I see every one of you as I turn around very clearly. My brain is going to the eye that's visible, and it's taking all of this information in, And it's as if my right hand in front of my right eye is just kind of along the side. The brain does what it needs to do so your eyes will work the way God has designed them. It's really amazing. So some of what we're being told from a human standpoint has an explanation. The only explanation we could surmise if we were to be asked, why did it take two steps? Because Jesus took two steps. He could have done anything, any way it needed to be done. But he brings the person into the circumstance. He brings a question and an answer into the circumstances. And it's a teaching method. It's a teaching opportunity. Healing a blind man. Comments, reflections, put your hand up if you need to. Whatever you want to do. Tommy?
So the human eye is the greatest scientific evidence against evolution.
Yes.
Because it's a precise instrument that does marvelous things that cannot be replicated by a machine. And why would it have evolved into that?
Yeah.
It came from the maker that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Terry Stead was an artist, a painter. He painted rooms, too, from time to time, but he was an artist from the standpoint. And I think at the end of his life, he had about 1,200 paintings in several foreign countries and several American states as well. We're blessed to have a few. And when they moved in with us toward the end of their life, he realized that there's a market out there. Now, what are you calling it? The internet. And how does this work, Bachelor? I can't tell you. And you're going to do what? And he had questions that, just like most of us, there's no explaining it, but this is what it does. And so I had a pretty nice 35-millimeter camera. It had film. It wasn't digital as they are now. And we would go outside on a bright sunny day, and we would go outside on a bright cloudy day, and we would take pictures to put on the internet so that perhaps they could be sold. We put a few on eBay from time to time. And he would look at it. Gary, it's not showing the true colors. It was so frustrating to him that it did not show the actual colors, the nuances of colors that were clearly seen. There's the key word, clearly seen on the canvas. And he was so frustrated. We did it again. We would do it again. And finally it dawned on me, that VA moment. That lens that God puts here can never be replicated with the best of cameras. Our eyes see things that you cannot replicate with a camera, the best of cameras. And he knew that. He could understand that, but it was frustrating. Eyes to be able to see. John 9, it's the master of misfortune in John's signage, his seven miracles that operate under the Simeon motif. And I want us to not rush. We have enough time to do it credit, and it's not a new circumstance for most of us. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth, John 9, verse 1. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They believed what some people, even Christians today, still believe, that if some deformity or some misfortune or some circumstance happens in our life, God, what have I done to deserve this? They may not say, "What sin have I committed?" The three friends who came to comfort Job offered no comfort because they had the same doctrinal issue as the disciples had. "Job, you're suffering greatly, so your sin must be a really big one. You have been a big sinner because you are suffering greatly." The disciples believe that. Someone sinned. Now, I don't understand it. And of course, when you come up with a false premise, then everything attached to it doesn't necessarily make common sense. Who sinned? This man? He was born blind, so did he sin in the womb? Did he sin as a young child? What are they saying? Well, that's not so crazy, is it? Because there are a lot of people in the religious world today that believe children are born inherently with sin in their life. A child is born in sin. And that's why there are infant baptisms in some of those circumstances. They believe the man must have sinned. He was born blind, so when did it happen? That's where the doctrine begins to fade. But what about his parents? What did his parents do to deserve this? They must have sinned. Now, it's possible that parents could eat and take of things that would be sinful and it would affect a baby in the womb. You can't ignore that possibility. That's not what they were supposing. They were raising an issue with a common belief that's held by many people today. Luke 13, some Galileans taking sacrifices to offer, and they were slaughtered by Pilate. Were they more sinful than the others in Jerusalem? Jesus asked. A Tower of Siloam fell on individuals. Were they more sinful, Luke 13, than others on that day because a tower fell on them and they died? In both cases, Jesus says, no, that's not to be considered. Here, neither this man nor his parents sinned. So when you talk to people who wonder, why am I being punished? What sin have I committed because something has happened in my life? Go to John 9 and go to Luke 13 and see the equivocal statement of Jesus. It's clear. This wasn't because of sin on the part of the man or the parents. Why did it happen? But this happened, verse 3, so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. Sometimes circumstances happen, terrible as they are, but it's an opportunity to glorify God. It's an opportunity for the works of God to be displayed. And he tells us, whether we understand it or not, he tells us a no, and he tells us an affirmation. Stan? Yes. I'm listening as I look because I never remember the two Old Testament passages from memory. I've written them down, and it may be in my New Testament rather than this. I will find them before next week. No, here they are. Thank you, Father. Deuteronomy 24, verse 16. Deuteronomy 24, verse 16. Fathers shall not be put to death for their children, nor children put to death for their fathers. Each is to die for his own sin. And Ezekiel 18:20. I've got to find Ezekiel. The soul who sins is the one who will die. Ezekiel 18:20. The son will not share the guilt of the father, nor will the father share the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous man will be credited to him, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against him. The consequences of our actions will be passed down unless somebody breaks the pattern. And in any type of mental or physical abuse, addictions, some of those things, they tend to be repeated unless someone breaks the cycle in a family. But the scriptures tell us that we will be judged and we will be condemned based on our actions. But consequences can be passed down. The ramifications of my actions can be passed down because they're not broken or they're not retaught or untaught. It's true in the affirmative. My faith, my family's faith, can be passed down to a second or third generation. Some of us are part of those families. But it's got to be taught and received and followed with those next generations. It works in both categories. Let's quickly read, go back to John 9. We've answered the question that's raised. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. Now, what has he just used? Someone who cannot see, therefore their eyes are dark, their awareness is dark, if you will, to make very strong statements about light. Light and night. And I'm the light of the world. And that's the teaching style of John, to use a word and make a stronger point. Having said this, verse 6, he spit on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, put it on the man's eyes. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word meant sent. And the man washed and came home seeing. And John spends a great deal of time seeing the debate. The Pharisees don't want to admit that he was healed. So they called the parents in. Was your son blind? Yes. What happened? I don't know, but he was blind and now he can see. He calls the son in. They call the son in and have a debate whether he really was blind, as if you would pretend to do that for many, many years. John uses it to show the blindness of the religious leaders. and their failure at some point even of coming in and accusing parents and others of lying, as if they were pretending he was blind when he was not. That's another story. It closes with teachings on spiritual blindness. John 6 at the end. Richard?
And Jesus is the firstborn of his earthly family, and he's the firstborn of God. And so by doing that in front of the Jewish people, they would make that connection that that is a reason why he may be doing his fiddle as a healing quality.
Thank you. And the firstborn is talked about many times in the scriptures. Christ is the firstborn of the dead. Let's come back to John 9. There's a lot of lessons here, but we'll just mention them in respect to the miracle that's being reported for us.